Hello, pals. Thank you as ever for tuning in to Worst Foot Forward, and hopefully this week raising a pint to the world's worst beer. If you are the sort of people who enjoy tasting new, inventive, and bizarre beers, then the ones we talk about in this show, particularly and most obviously James's Lazy IPA, are available for purchase, and we'll stick a link in the show notes for you to buy James's beer. Please try it out. Let us know what you think of it. Most importantly, though, we've got a live show to announce on Sunday, the 5th of November, a date that is apparently extremely easy to remember if you are English and enjoy burning Catholics. We are doing a live show as part of the Cheerful Earful podcast. It is at the Bedford Pub in Balham. Comedy lovers who go and see the Banana Cabaret shows will know it very well. We are on at midday on the Sunday, so you can enjoy our show for an hour, then go have a roast dinner either at the Bedford or at one of the many delightful pubs in the area. You can also buy tickets for the whole weekend of shows, I think, and we're sharing the bill with some incredible podcasts, including Pappy's Flatshare Slamdown, Lex Education, The Trusty Hogs, Born Yesterday. So please do come down and enjoy the show with us. We will have a special guest with us. We are not going to announce them yet, and I'm going to leave it up to you to decide whether that's because we're being all so mysterious or we're being all so haven't booked them yet. But by the next time you hear this podcast, we will announce them, if that's the sort of whetting your appetite requires. But hopefully the prospect of seeing me and Barry in a room together in real life in South London being very silly for an hour will be enough to attract you. The ticket link, as ever, in the show notes as well. So hop on the good foot, do the bad thing, press the ticket link, buy some tickets, and we will see you in Balham in just over a month's time. But for now, raise your glasses and enjoy a mighty pint's worth of Worst Foot Forward.
Hello and welcome to Worst Foot Forward, where we celebrate the best of the worst. I'm Barry McStay, and each week I, my co-host, and our guest propose our candidates for the title of the world's worst something. This week, it's time to put on our beer goggles. Along with our beer speedos and beer flippers, dive into the beer pool to compete in the Beer Olympics, swim the 100 beer style, and then celebrate winning our golden beer medals with a lovely cool pint of water. And belly flopping alongside me is the full body to my frothy head. It's Ben Vandeveld.
Bo, a beer, a female beer, hops, put them in my mouth. Hella, that started off in my head, and then I was like, you don't know the rest of the scale, do you?
you're a connoisseur of the alcoholic beverages of sorts. Every time we go play board games at yours, you always have some interesting beers and spirits.
Well, that is thanks to my local bottle shop, The Good Drinker. Massive shout out to them. If you live in West Norwood or anywhere nearby, do get down to the bottom of Knights Hill, because A, they stock delicious beers, and B, when my Italian father-in-law went in there and chatted to the Italian lady behind the counter, he was like, "You got good wines here, I can see they're from Italy, that's where I'm from." She went, "No, you're not." And then he spoke Italian at her, and she was like, "Oh, let me show you the good stuff." So we have a very close relationship with them. As we will no doubt discuss with our guest, there is some craft beer that I like. In fact, I've got a funny feeling I don't like craft beer, because I think that's beer that was made in the past 15 years by gentlemen with tattoos and beards. Whereas what I actually like is wheat beer crafted by monks for over 800 years. That's what I like. And the stuff that I like is really thick. It's basically liquid bread is what I like.
Yeah. that's the good
oh,
stuff.
Oh, yeah.
You want to be able to taste the religious input.
I mean, speaking as a Jew, no, I want to be able to taste the heretical input. We might find out as the show goes on. I don't understand why monks are the only religious figures that make beer. It should be that they do that, and that rabbis roll Cuban cigars on their thighs. But I...
and nuns cut the finest of heroin.
Well, of course, yes. Have you ever really chased the dragon unless it's been created by Mother Superior? Actually,
yeah.
I mean, I think what we all know, given the wars in Afghanistan for the past 20 years, naughty imams make the best heroin. And if you want to find out about that, head to naughtyimams.com. .xxx.kkk actually given. Oh no, case no, that case ketamine. That's horse tranquilizer, not horse the drug. We've ended up down a different narcotic wormhole. I do apologize. Not that alcohol is a narcotic, but it should be illegal if other drugs are allowed to be illegal. What I'm saying is,
sometimes I find listeners is just best to let him get it out early so that we can then do a podcast.
Yeah, sorry, that's fair. Hello, yes, I like beer. Shall I introduce our guest? Good.
Ideally, yes.
Our guest this week is a comedian, author, and brewer. A combination as dangerously potent as a nitroglycerin salesman and chain smoker, or former journalist and prime minister. From humble beginnings in the rural southwest of England, he has gone on to headline clubs all over the globe, from Shanghai to Slovakia, Malta to Melbourne. Since then, he has appeared on TV on Russell Howard's Good News and Ricky Gervais's Extras, where he played the Count in the David Bowie episode. Absolutely more questions on that in a moment. He is also the author of The Pub Manifesto, A Comedian Stands Up for Pubs, which was published by Camera Books in November 2018. It was nominated for the Guild of British Beer Writers Award, which I think we can all agree is an award that all of us would like to be nominated for, and it was nominated for a Long Live the Local Award for the Best Books on Pubs in 2019. It was even name-checked as one of the best Christmas books by a comedian in the London Evening Standard. More recently, he has teamed up with the Brolly Brewing Company in Surrey to create the recipe for Lazy IPA. Brewed with added Olicana hops for a more tropical flavour, it is a fun, easy-drinking English IPA at a 4.8% APV. It contains citrus flavours of lemon, melon and honey with a hint of tropical fruit and goes well with a spicy curry. This, friends, is of course nonsense, as IPA is one of the most disgusting drinks on earth that is nothing more than glorified drain cleaner. But, you know, each to their own. So, having committed social harikiri, but knowing I'll probably get away with it with such a fine, charming and self-effacing guest, it is a delight to welcome a comic with a tasty body and a fine head. It is James Dowdswell.
What an introduction. What an introduction. I love it. I love it. I quite like a bit of liquid bread as well.
Yeah. Oh.
You're in very good company, because I seem to remember that Bob Mortimer of Reeves and Mortimer fame is also keen on brewing at the moment. Has been brewing a bit. So yeah, I believe so. How did you get into it? Did you just like beer, and then you ended up getting into a conversation with someone else in the pub who's like, I'm a brewer, and then it went from there?
Kind of. It was actually I did a comedy night for a brewery, and during lockdown, and they sent me some beer, and I posted about it, and I was already posting a little bit about beer anyway, and then another brewery sent me some beer, and it sort of snowballed. During lockdown, I was getting sent quite a lot of free beer. And then I'd post about it. So I was a very, very minor influencer. I'd call myself a beer influencer under the influence.
Nicely done.
It does feel somewhat like a social experiment to go, oh, James is locked away on his own for a period of time. Let's just give him lots of different beers and see how he reacts to them.
Yeah, you were basically a beer guinea pig.
Yeah, one particular day, for example, Neil Waits, who you might know, runs comedy in a brewery. I had an idea for him. So he gave me 36 cans of beer, and I built rugby posts out of those cans. And then I kicked a can over those posts and filmed it. And my girlfriend came out and said, you know, I only told you to take out the recycling. And she said, how long is that? And I said, well, I've been given these beers for free. She goes, well, how long has that taken you to do it? And I went, I don't know, 3 hours. Build all the posts or whatever. And she said, well, that's just a bad waste of time. And then about a couple of weeks later, I went, Budvar invited me on one of their live tastings. And the brand manager of Budvar, Radim, gave this speech. And it was quite funny. And I thought it was a bit like stand-up. So I thought, hang on a minute, I can market beer. I can do the stand-up side. I could probably sell it. It's like selling an Edinburgh ticket. All I need to do is brew it. Why don't I, instead of actually sort of tagging other people, why don't I try and market my own beer. So I had a word with Neil and we started to brew our own beer at his brewery. But it's actually more difficult than you think. And I think it would take me 3 to 5 years to get to the level I wanted to. So I ended up using a professional brewer. So I did what's called a contract brew, where you discuss what you want. So for example, Ben, you might say, I want some liquid bread, describe everything, and the brewer will do it for you. So that's what I ended up doing.
It makes me very jealous when people go, oh, I really like beer. And then someone goes, oh, do you want us to like help you monetize that passion of yours? Ben did mention the your extras episode as the Count or Count Dracula, I believe. it's great. Your Wikipedia entry is basically that. If you're going to be immortalized forever, what was that? What was that like?
It was brilliant fun. And I don't know if you've ever done the acting on TV. They get you there really early. And my whole bit, I actually thought that they were just practicing, but they'd rolled the cameras and they pretty much got my bit on the second take. What happened was Ricky Gervais looked at me, you know, and I only had one line. I was meant to say, Ricky Gervais' character says, Andy Millman says, why do they call you Count Fuckler? And I meant to say, because I can't stop shagging me, I can't stop. But I looked at Ricky Gervais in the eyes and I blanked. So I just improvised. I went, because if I see something, I've got to fuck it. And then there was a voice in my over my right shoulder went, cut, that's a keeper. Well, have they, Steve Merchant. And they asked me to do it again, and they kept that line.
Nice work. And you weren't, am I right in saying, in a scene with Bowie? Or did you?
No.
Did you get to, unfortunately, not. Near him?
No, it was me, David Earle, and Ricky Gervais, and a bunch of extras. One little fact for you, we got to choose our own clothes. I don't know if you've ever been to the BBC wardrobe department, but you get paid £50, and you go, and you can pick out your clothes. And I picked out some stonewashed jeans, and I wore Richard Iowodi's high-tech silver shadow trainers that he wore on the IT Crowd. I wore them as Count Fuckler.
Oh, nice. What a great lineage those trousers have. I'd love it if some of the stuff in the wardrobe just goes back, you know, decades. These were trousers worn by Sir John Mills and then Jennifer Saunders and Richard Iorda and now you, James Dowdell. Yeah.
I think Dame Vera Lynn's gusset is probably still in there.
Well, it's a real treasure trove, you know. Have you ever been to Snooper's Paradise in Brighton?
I have not.
It's a bit like that. It is a real treasure trove. It's fantastic. Yeah, there was like a whole rack of Jonathan Ross's suits, for example. It was beautiful.
I also, just going back to what Barry said, I do feel like Dame Vera Lynn's gusset is a brew that should never be made.
Yeah, exactly. That's brilliant. Yeah, Dame Vera Lynn's gusset.
You're evidently very good at finding your niche. Shall we say? What are you the worst at in the world?
I was thinking about this last night, and I came up with quite a few things. I reckon I could generally be the worst at a few things, and I've settled upon one thing: cricket.
Oh, I think the England One Day side are giving you a good run for their money at the moment.
That is absolutely incorrect. I went to watch them at the Oval on Wednesday, and Ben Stokes thumped the biggest ever score by an English player.
So, well good, done. Well done for him. I don't care.
Well done.
The joke will stand, and I will cut that out. why are you so bad at cricket, James? Apart from the fact that there's only one of you and not 11.
Well, I should be good. I'm going to throw a name check in there. I spoke to Russell Howard this morning, and he said, "But Dad, you should be good at cricket. You know, because you look like a cricketer." I said, "How do you mean?" Well, because I do look quite bookish. I've got glasses. Mm. I speak quite well, and I've been to private school, so I should be good at cricket. But the main problem is, I've got a lazy eye, so I can't focus on the ball. So I can play ball sports, for example, tennis. I'm quite good at tennis, but when I first play tennis, I see two balls coming at me for the first couple of, I don't know, minute or two. I decide which one it is, and then my brain works out which one it is, and it blocks out the other ball. So I often see double. But in cricket, you don't have time to You can't say, can you bowl it again? I can see two balls coming down the track. Not only that, the ball in cricket swings. Often people swing and swerve it. So even when it's straight, it looks like it's swinging to me. So it's very difficult and you only get one chance. So I only see the ball last minute. So it's basically this kind of cannonball just flying towards you. Not only that, some bloke has rubbed it on his crotch for extra movement. He's rubbing this thing on his balls. So this smelly thing, leather, is coming flying towards you and I've got to hit it with a plank of wood. I was just useless. And so my nervous system was going through the roof and I just couldn't relax. I just, didn't like it at all. And then playing out in the field, you play out in the field and, I, like most comedians, I'm not great at concentrating. I'm a bit of a dreamer. So I'd be out in the field and, you know, it's so boring out there in silly mid wicket or whatever it is. And you just drift off and suddenly the ball's coming. People are shouting because the ball's coming towards you. Then you panic and miss it. I've been to see a live match once. I went to Edgbaston with the school and I saw England versus India. Mike Gatting was in bat. But I was more concerned with a few rows back over my left-hand shoulder was Gary Lineker watching it. And this is in 1986, so it was just about the Mexico World Cup was about to happen. So I was very excited about that. In fact, I got him to sign my Mexico 86 sticker book.
That is amongst the most 1980 sporting memories it's possible to have.
But I wouldn't say everything's bad with cricket. I eventually found my position. I was a very good 12th man in that I love being 12th man because there's no possibility of you getting on. It's not like you're a substitute who comes on. 12th man, you don't substitute in cricket. So I was just safe. I could relax because the best thing about cricket...
Did you do the scoring?
No, I wasn't even allowed to do that because I was the maths. So what I was good at was eating the cricket teas. They're amazing. You know, I love football. I quite like rugby. And we got half-time oranges. But with cricket, you've got Cuba sandwiches, salmon, flapjacks, lovely cup of tea, cake. I mean, it's worth going through all that boredom to get to that dinner. So with 12th man, it was quite good because I could read a book and just sort of quietly by the scoreboard guy and then have me lunch.
Oh, you see, that's why cricket does appeal to those of us who are bad at sport.
Yes.
It's the amount of sitting around not playing sport you can do.
Yeah, I mean... Armchair, so it's a good armchair cricketer.
Yeah,
but I do think I'm the worst.
Sort of dreadful euphemism.
But yes, but I'd say, you know, with cricket, I'm an all-rounder. I was all-round bad at it. You know, I was bad at every single aspect of it, and I hated the kit. It was all white or cream. The jumper was kind of itchy. The boots were uncomfortable. The pads. To do the pads up, I had skinny legs, so I had to pull them too tight. They're all baggy. And then they insist on you have to wear a box. And you put this box down. And you know, sometimes you think, oh, I'm boxed. But a friend of mine, Stinger, he gave it the big I am, went in at number three, and he got pelted in the ball bag. So one of the funniest things I've ever seen, to be honest.
Do you know what? I had exactly the same problem when I took part in burlesque.
shouldn't have given the crowd those snooker balls. Yeah.
I spoke about in the introduction that particularly in medieval times monks and abbots and the like would brew a lot of beer, but who else, gentlemen, would brew an awful lot of the beer that was consumed in the Middle Ages?
Ladies. Brewsters.
Ah, got it. In what? Brewsters, yes. Otherwise known as alewives.
Ah.
Yeah, alewives. Yeah.
Yeah, women have been a key part of this going all the way back into ancient times. In fact, there is, in the Epic of Gilgamesh from ancient Mesopotamia, there is a divine alewife, Siduri, who I think might be my new god. And obviously, I think it's fairly commonly known that ale and beer was drunk in medieval times in Europe because it was purer than water, and it wasn't really drunk to be inebriated, though that was a fun side effect. It was purely for the hygiene reason. But the reason why women did it so much is that because it could be done from the home. And so it was part of like a supplemented portfolio of income, which makes it sound considerably more sophisticated than it was. But because so many other things, routes to income were closed down to women, whereas this was an essential thing for society and could be done at home. And because sort of women higher up the social chain wouldn't do it because there was a bit of social stigma, like working class women or peasant women, I guess at that time, would do it. And I didn't realise that Brewster was the female term. So obviously one of my favourite movies growing up was Brewster's Millions, starring Richard Pryor.
Yeah, yeah.
So I didn't realise that was his surname. Next, I discovered some fairly deadly beer. There is a brewery in St Giles in London called the Horseshoe Brewery. And in 1810, the brewery installed 22-foot-high wooden fermentation tank. Great, they're meeting the demand. And it was held together by giant iron rings. However, 4 years later, one of those iron rings snapped. The tank exploded, and a tsunami of beer was released into London. And it made the back wall of the brewery collapse. And the pressure also broke other containers of liquid so that a 4.5 meter tidal wave containing 1.2 million litres of beer flooded the streets. It being London at that time, the area nearby was densely populated with slums, and 8 people drowned in what I think we can all agree in one of the best ever ways to go.
It's a little bit grimmer than that, because 5 of the people who died were at a wake for an Irish family. Yeah. Seems a bit on the nose for the Irish stereotype as well, as to kill us all with beer. Do you know what else happened, though? They got a rebate from the His Majesty's Excise for the lost beer.
Did they?
They nearly went bankrupt, and they avoided collapse because they got a rebate. But the brewery moved in the 1920s, and it's now the site of the Dominion Theatre at the corner of Tottenham Court Road and Oxford.
Oh, is that where it was?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Good Lord. Yeah. I guess just thinking of people being overwhelmed by beer, we saw our friends Paul and Laurie yesterday, who were in France last week, when people were underwhelmed with beer because the French stadiums ran out of beer. And they were talking about how when anyone managed to get to the front of the queue and get some beer, that the response from the crowd was actually like they were holding the Ark of the Covenant, and they were just leaving a golden path for them to take that beer out into the rest of the stadium. I had a little look at unusual beers and unusual flavours, which I bet you lads have got a lot of. So I'll just tell you about a couple of them. Saturday Morning IPA by Smart Mouth is also known as Lucky Charms beer, because it is it was a limited draft released in cans in Norfolk, Virginia, using toasted marshmallows and cereal marshmallows from Lucky Charms to make the sour mash.
They didn't have the bits floating in the beer.
No, I believe not. So there's that I found. I found an absolutely mad one made by the 40 Feet Brewery. And what they did is they went to, I don't know how they got permission for this, but they talked to the estate of Roald Dahl, and they went to Roald Dahl's old writing chair and took a swab from it and used what they found there to create a yeast, which they then used as the basis for a beer.
Wow.
Which they called George's Very Unmarvelous Medicine.
which they called Mr. Twit's Odious Ale.
Wow. That's incredible.
Yeah, I know.
This is
pick
fabulous
the grossest
stuff.
Style creation. Yeah.
Really, yes, is. Obviously that was a beer that took German purity laws very seriously.
Yeah. You can really taste the anti-Semitism.
You can. And the other sort of gimmicky one that I found is from Borgarfjordur in Iceland. It's a beer called Hvalur, which combines two of nature's finest resources, pure Icelandic water and whale's testicles smoked in sheep dung.
Oh, Iceland never changed.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's, obviously...
That feels like the after party on I'm a Celebrity, doesn't it?
Yeah. You open the can and you have the sound of Bjork making geezer noises.
Yeah. Oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah, and obviously the hangover on that, you just are on the couch going... One last one, just purely on the name. One of my favourite lagers is Helles Lager, and Helles is German for pure. And I joked about it before, but, you know, Germany like to precision engineer everything, and Germany famously does have purity, the fun purity laws about their beer, rather than the other less fun German purity laws. I'm sure, as gentlemen who've worked in the comedy industry, we are all aware of the small German village called Fucking. And so you'll be delighted to know that in 2013...
Bane of Rhodes.
they made Fucking Hell Lager.
Oh, brilliant. Oh, beautiful.
I know.
Come on.
In the words of Jeff Goldblum, just because you should doesn't mean you could. But in this case, they can. And they did.
Oh my God.
At first, the European Union's Trademarks and Designs Registration Office refused to grant a trademark on the grounds that it was an expletive. But the makers were like, nope, it's a name and a type of good. And they got away with it.
Wow.
And, yeah, so I...
They knew exactly what they were doing.
Of course they did. Of course they did. So I'm delighted that that exists. But for my world's worst beer, we are going to Poland/the Kingdom of Bohemia in the year 1380. And I'm going to tell you about the Wrocław Beer War. Depending on what part of the ethnic/linguistic seesaw you live on, it's either Wrocław or Wrocław. So that is a place that's the capital of Silesia, that now corresponds to bits of Austria, Czech Republic, Germany, and Poland, because, you know, European history, borders gonna sort of shift. So in 1327, it severed ties to the Polish crown and joined the Kingdom of Bohemia, where it would stay until 1945. And like I said before, beer was a central component of both the public diet and public life. And what would happen in Europe, particularly this part, is that town governments would run municipal breweries. That was because a lack of capital made it hard for private citizens to start their own beer-making operations. And it would be a key part of like the exchequer. And also, beer coming in, the tax on it would often make up 20, 30, 40% of the income. So... In Bohemian Wrocław, there was, like I said, just one institution making beer, and the city council was called Rat or Rata, and it was brewed in a basement right under the town hall. Essentially, it was run sort of as a beer racket, and the beer was known as Schweidnitz or Schweidnicker. That's what was sold amongst the Wrocławers. However, by 1380, many of the local inhabitants decided to ditch this beer in exchange for beer brewed by monks on the nearby island of Ostrzatumski. And the guys in charge of the city council were not particularly happy with this, but monks being monks were very rich. And so they started to keep a lot of the grain and the barley for themselves because they had more land and they could afford to do that. The reason they could do that is because even though it was close to the city, the island was not subject to municipal laws. Obviously, it was subject to church laws. And what had happened is that...
That old excuse. Yeah. They've been using that for bloody millennia. Yeah.
The bishop, Wenceslaus II, who basically took over after the previous one died, he allowed the monks there to do as they pleased. But so when the island started to disrupt the monopoly of the municipal council, the council began by declaring a trade war. they started saying that goods going to the island had to pass through the town, and they would either tax them or stop them getting through. So the church started excommunicating members of the city council to stop them blockading. Then they escalated things, and they put the entire city under interdict, which meant that no religious service could be conducted within it. Basically, according to the article I've read, the bishop cut Wroclaw off from God so he could keep selling beer, which is a lovely sentence to read in a historical document.
What human beings are so reasonable, oh, aren't God, we?
So are. The tricky thing for the council is that the Wroclawers preferred what the monks were brewing. And so when things came to a head, the Rata, the council, didn't really have them on side. But they basically got so angry, they decided to invade the island with an army of local mercenaries who didn't really want to do that because they wanted to drink the monks' beer. So what happened is they got to the island, they trashed it, and then they started drinking the beer there. And there is stories of them trashing the place, dressing up in clerical outfits, and then looting church property whilst drinking beer.
Wow.
So that's amazing. It turned into a stag do, essentially.
Yes!
And it got to the extent that Pope Gregory the 12th had to intercede and lift the religious ban via a papal bull, thus restoring the monopoly of the council.
I know he would have just sent letters and envoys and things, but I do like the idea of Pope Gregory the 12th walking in on this, like, looting, drunken, dressed up as monk sight, and then we're going, sketch, lads, sketch, the Pope's here. And Greg going, what on earth is going on in here? Nothing.
And just for the final epilogue, in 1418, an angry mob of Wroclaw guildsmen decided to protest against the excessive taxes from the council, and also, you know, nepotism and corruption. They stormed the town hall and killed six councilmen, including the mayor. And the bishop at the time, a new guy called Conrad the IV, he pre-absolved their sins for doing that.
This is like Trump with the preemptive pardons
really
again.
However, ultimately they didn't get away with it because the emperor came in 1420, he came to town for an imperial diet, and the ringleaders were rounded up and decapitated, and their heads were boiled, tarred, and affixed to the stakes on the city's walls. And one would hope that some of the tar that was put on their heads was then made into a yeast that created a new brew that became popular in the region.
Yeah.
So, wow. For all those reasons, I'm going to nominate the beers involved in the Wroclaw Beer War of 1380.
I'm just going for Carlsberg Special Brew.
Fair.
I don't know if it is the worst beer in the world, but probably it is getting there. It's a toss up between, I've got three beers.
I think that's their tagline, isn't it? Between.
Yeah, exactly. Is it the worst beer in the world? Probably.
The worst beer
in
the world.
Interesting thing about Carlsberg Special Brew. So it was not, it's got quite a bit of history to it. I know Ben loves his history. Apparently, Winston Churchill visited the Danish court in 1950 and they brewed Carlsberg Special Brew in honor of his visit. And apparently it was.
I'm sorry, that seems like a made up piece of history. I can't handle the notion of
it does.
Winston Churchill drinking special brew.
Well, apparently it was served to him. They served half special brew and half Pilsner, which is it's quite extraordinary. Have you ever had Carlsberg special brew?
I have not.
I had it at a party when I was about 17 or something, 18. And it just tastes of alcohol. It's quite thick. It's quite treacly. But it's changed now. It was 9%. They've put it down to 7.5%. And it'll probably come down even further because if you have a high alcohol beer these days, you get taxed more. So for tax purposes, they're bringing it down and down.
Also, it has a bit of a reputation as being, you know,
like a very
sort of destructive drink. I suppose that label, exactly, whether it's deserved or not, is probably on their mind.
And the choice drink of people who live outdoors. Also, there's Tennent's Super. But at least Tennent's Super is kind of, I think it stands for super strength beer. And the other beer I was contemplating was, do you remember Dog Bolter? It was brewed, I was in university in the late 90s, and it was brewed by the Firkin Brewery. It came out in, I think, 1979. And they had a thing at university. It was quite cheap. It was like £1.50 a pint or something, but it was quite strong. I think it was 6.5%. But if you drank 10 pints of it, you'd get a free T-shirt. So people used to try and drink 10 pints of this Dog Bolter. But your first pint was difficult because it tasted so disgusting. But once you'd had a few, and maybe you mixed it with scampi fries or something like that, you could get through a few.
I like the idea that they want to get, after 10 pints of that stuff, you get a free T-shirt, probably at the point at which your brain goes, I need to take all of my clothes off.
Or you've been sicker than the one you were wearing initially.
Yes, or maybe that's it. Yes, that's the consideration they were showing. Do you say it was founded in 1979, presumably to commemorate the resignation of Jim Callahan?
Yeah, exactly. There's some amazing beers out at the minute, but there's also some terrible ones as well. Skull Lager, a friend of mine mentioned this morning, wasn't very good. But most beers, even if you don't like them, are drinkable or you think that's well made. I can't think of any positive thing to say about Carlsberg Special Brew, unfortunately. I mean, Carlsberg Pilsner itself is popular because it doesn't really taste of anything at all. Because Pilsner is interesting because the original ones, Budvar, they do a sort of decoctation mash, and they actually have the beer filtrated and purified, and it's a really long process. So the Germans decided to make it quicker, and they made Pilsner, which is a quicker version of the Czech original, but I don't know how Carlsberg make their special brew, but I'm going to say Carlsberg special brew.
And when they brewed it for Churchill, was that presumably just for like an event? And then
according to the internet, apparently Churchill was visiting, so they brewed him this special beer, and maybe they were going to brew it anyway, and they just needed an excuse. When's the next alcoholic diplomat arriving in Denmark? Wonderful. Churchill's here. Let's brew this.
He's your number one. You want someone to be the face of the brand before he goes into insurance marketing.
Exactly. Exactly.
We'll have him as the face of this.
I've also because I want to be inclusive of you, I've been trying quite a few alcohol-free beers. And I can honestly say that Doombar alcohol-free is also free from taste. It's basically tastes of like a dirty dishcloth, and not even just watered down dishwater.
Yeah, I've tried non-alcoholic beer a couple of times, and because Caliber was kind of the first one that hit the market.
Yeah, that was made from that was more of a sort of malty drink rather than nowadays they make alcohol-free beer in two ways. One, you make a normal beer and you just keep the boil. So you basically, it's like vegetables. You just boil out all the alcohol. You boil the alcohol off. And the other way, they're now starting to make it from scratch. But rather than making an alcohol beer, they actually make it properly. But they normally use about 0.5% of alcohol because it gives it the backbone. It gives it the...
You're right, James. Alcohol does give us backbone.
But they used to say Guinness is good for you. They genuinely were touted the health benefits of Guinness and lots of other beers, because during World War II especially, you had the hangover, if you'll pardon the expression, it was the hangover of the temperance movements of the teens and the 20s, and they sort of tried to use the World War as an impetus to ban alcohol, said, oh, you know, we need to focus on the good of the nation. But it was basically the temperance movement dressing up with, you know, the war in mind. And the beer companies all got together and went, well, we need to fight back against this. Let's just all claim that beer is really healthy for you.
Yeah, I mean, it has got vitamin B and it has got some vitamins in it, but you have to drink an awful lot to get the vitamin content.
I think you could argue that the vitamin intake is counterbalanced in some way.
Yes.
It's like the issue I have with my children. This is. I think I've noticed quite a few children like this, so I don't think it's that they are enormously sophisticated, but both my kids love olives, and I'm like, great, could you possibly eat vegetables that have slightly more nutritional value than them? Because my children would need to eat, like, most of the olives tree in the Lebanon in order to retrieve any sort of nutritional value from them.
Have you had any particularly, like, weird beers with weird ingredients in there? I remember tasting Fruly for the first time when I did used to drink about 15 years ago, and that's a strawberry
love
beer.
Yes. Fruly.
And
Fruly's delightful. But I tell you what, I had not this Friday, but last Friday, I had I went to Bermondsey Beer Mile and picked some beer up for more beer, and one of the beers, they had a smoked lager. And I said to the guys there, you know, I said, oh, this is interesting. Yeah, we brewed it specially. He was claiming basically that they'd come up with the idea. And I said, so it's not based on the Jalenka beer in Germany that was brewed from 1892 then? Yeah. The Jalenka beer, if you've ever had that, it's a bottled beer and German beer, and it's so smoky. The first time I had it, I didn't realise, and I tasted it. I thought, blimey, it smells of bacon. Delicious.
I've had stuff at the Old Red Cow in Farringdon that's like, but it's like bacon and chocolate. It's amazing.
Yes. Yeah, it's quite incredible. And it's beautiful beers. And also, you know, you're right, you were saying about the craft beers you weren't interested in, but I think because a lot of craft beers are based on those American hot bombs, there was probably last summer and maybe the summer before, there was all these sort of massively hot bomb citrus IPAs, but they all tasted the same really. I found them a bit dull after a while, so started seeking out other things. We initially brewed a sort of more hazy tropical IPA, and we've changed it now to more English IPA because it was slightly different. You know, I was tasting it and thinking, you know what, I feel like I've tasted this before, so I wanted something not original but just more distinctive.
And for a non beer drinker like me,
yes,
obviously there's all the different, you know, strands of IPAs and ales and lagers and things, but where do they all start the same way? You get some cereal grains and you bring out the sugars in them.
Yeah, I mean, yes they do, really. They all start the same. Lager varies, you know, say for example Budvar spend a lot more time on their lager than a pilsner, but in terms of craft beer, what tends to happen is towards the end of the brew, you can dry hop your beer, so you're basically adding extra hops. And what a lot of craft breweries do now is adding all sorts of exciting hops at the end of the brew. So it's a bit like, I don't know, putting different spices in your curry. So everybody's got the same sort of curry to start with, and you add different spices or different things, or, you know, swabs from Roald Dahl's chair or whatever you want to add to make it slightly different. So that's in a nutshell, that's kind of what we're dealing with.
If you were going to get a swab from an author's chair to make a beer, which author would you choose, James?
Do you know what? When you told that story, it was buzzing in my head. I thought, I must remember that. Let's stand up to riff off that. I'm a big fan of Withnall and I, so it would have to be sort of, swab from maybe Bruce Robinson's leather jacket, or maybe not Withnall's coat because that looks pretty disgusting, or something along those lines. I'd probably have a Withnall beer, but It's a great concept, isn't it? What about you guys?
I'd vote for Edgar Allan Poe, but it's probably already a full, like, 12-year-aged whiskey by the time you'd get the swab from his chest.
Yes.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, it wouldn't be beer. It would have to be kind of like a tiny, tiny shot of the most potent spirit, but just a little swab from Hunter S. Thompson's bucket hat.
Yeah. And maybe fired.
That would be dangerous.
Fired into the vat with an air rifle.
Yeah. Yes.
In pellet form.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
It's very old beer.
Yeah.
Between sort of fifth millennium BC, they were found a trace of it in Mesopotamia. They were drinking in Egypt and China and Europe, all sort of around the same time. It was interesting, sort of basically. And I love reading this phrase because every now and again I'll read something and it'll talk about how we had to domesticate certain grains. And it does make me think of humans and hunting dogs trying to round up a field of wheat.
trying to
get them under control.
Also, a lot of these areas where history says dictates that brewing started are now all kind of dry areas, aren't they? They're dry states.
Yeah, it's funny that it's true that the earliest chemically confirmed barley beer was found in Iran. You get the Fertile Crescent. You get the humans are domesticating wheats and barleys and various other founder crops, which help develop agriculture. And when you've got those, along with basically wild yeasts in the air, according to this article, fermentation probably began to happen spontaneously. And then humans noticed and cottoned on.
Yeah, go, ooh, that's a cheeky bit of rainwater.
Yeah.
it's one of those bits of human evolution where various places all around the world we're sort of all doing it all at the same time.
Just all around the globe, humans are like, God, I need a drink. Ooh.
Yes. That was cold, wasn't it? I read about, what do you think the country with the highest beer consumption per capita is? This is according to stats from 2020.
I reckon it's either Australia or, I was going to say, or somewhere like Czech Republic.
It is Czech Republic by a huge distance.
Yeah.
181.7, I think that is, it must be pints per head, ahead of, or units. Austria is second with 96. It's nearly double.
Wow.
It's a huge disparity. Ireland, for those of you who are stereotyping in the background, were 11th. it's a lovely list of sort of basically the former Iron Curtain countries.
Yeah.
You got Czech Republic, Austria, Poland, Romania, Germany, Estonia, Lithuania, a cheeky Namibia at number 8, Slovakia, and then Spain and Ireland are 10.
What are Namibia doing in there?
Yeah.
Not sure. Well, it is true that there's more, I think, because the second Guinness brewery in the world was opened in Nigeria. And so there's a higher consumption of, I think, Guinness is consumed at a higher rate in Nigeria than it is in Ireland.
I've had Namibian beer when I was on our honeymoon in Botswana, and they had, I think it's from Namibia, called Windhoek, and it was properly delicious.
Oh.
Why does it have a Dutch name, you ask? Well, I think we can all agree that it's not a happy story, is it?
I read a bit. Then when I saw the stats, I read a bit more about the Czech Republic and why they have such an affinity for beer. And the earliest evidence of a brewery in the Czech Republic is a monastery, unsurprisingly enough, the Brevnov Monastery in Prague, founded in 993. And by a sort of 100 years later, there's another account of brewing in the Czech Republic by someone called Vratislav II. He mentions the use of hops in brewing. And that 1088 is a few hundred years before hops are being widely used in other countries to help develop their beers. So Czech hops were really highly prized. They would get the highest price at various markets around Europe. Hops for brewing weren't even grown in Britain until 1524, so a half a millennium later. But thanks to various reasons, including, of course, the communist rule and central planning. The number of breweries in the Czech Republic was reduced to about 60 in the early 21st century. It was very, very low indeed. The country now has more than 400 breweries. That's in about a 20-year period.
Wow. Oh, wow, I love that.
Absolutely. They've exploded, and that's kind of partly due to people, if you like, sending brewing back to the Czech Republic. The microbrewery and craft brewing trend in America, for example, has sort of imported itself back to the Czech Republic.
Yeah, and do you know how the craft beer movement started in the UK? It was... this is part of my show, actually. But in 2002, Gordon Brown, my lazy-eyed brother from another mother, he, in the part of his budget, he brought forward a progressive beer tax, which taxed breweries less, small breweries less than everyone else. And so he gave birth to BrewDog. He gave them tax breaks, and then they started brewing beer, and they started quite a few of them started looking towards the American craft beer scene, and so that's why you've got all these American craft beers style over here. But it wasn't until 2002, and then of course it's cheaper now. You need to sell them somewhere, and the cheapest premises are on industrial estates, so they all have industrial estates, warehouses, taps to so they can brew and sell their beer. It's a bit like gastropubs. I mean, gastropubs started, the Eagle started, because it was very hard to get a license to brew beer, but restaurants were quite easy. So they sort of turned their pub into a restaurant. They would tax less.
God, humans were so ingenious.
I know, anything to avoid tax, isn't it? But I mean, the tax is going up, and you know, my beer, I'm on my second brew, and this beer costs more than the last beer. One, because the malted barley comes from Ukraine, obviously that's more scarce, and secondly, because it's taxed higher by the government. So you have this weird thing where Rishi Sunak turned up at the Great British Beer Festival, thinking he'd given a tiny bit of tax relief to brewers, and then there's just loads of people with selfies with pointing two fingers up at Rishi. But it is quite strange, really, that you've got Rishi at the Great British Beer Festival taking pictures of himself with a pint, having his party led us out of Europe after a guy who wanted to get out of Europe, Nigel Farage, is pictured with a load of pints of beer. So it's a very strange time.
Yeah. Both doing their very level best to keep the brewers at bay.
Exactly, exactly. But it's getting, the margins are getting tighter, as with everything. And also, cost of living and the energy crisis, a lot of breweries are really struggling. I'm sort of doing what's known as cuckooing, where you go into a brewery and make your beer. Well, that's that part of the market's doing quite well. But people who've invested in big breweries trying to catch up with BrewDog or Beavertown, of struggle. But that's the same with everything. Everyone who tries to move too quickly can get caught.
Yeah, and there are always people who want to shut those loopholes as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
For various reasons. There's just a little coda to the mention of the Czech Republic's thing. That oldest brewery I mentioned, the one founded at the monastery in 993, it was destroyed during the war, then it was rebuilt, then it was closed during the communist era, and it reopened again 10 years ago in 2013. So it's still going strong. And Prague has at least 30 breweries in it, and a beer museum.
Ooh, where you're not allowed to drink any of the exhibits.
Yes, I think that's probably right.
We've got a national brewing museum in Burton-on-Trent, but unfortunately that was closed down 2 years ago.
Oh, no. Was it one of those that was sort of a living museum?
Yeah. So I was going to go to it, and then I looked and it was closed, so I just missed out. It was in Burton-on-Trent, because all the big breweries used to be in Burton-on-Trent, and I think it was just less popular, or less people knew about it. I think it lack of funding,
Well, you can imagine the local newspapers led with last orders for Burton-on-Trent, because that always seems to be the headline when an esteemed long-standing pub closes, something like that. It's a personal bugbear of mine. And sidebar, if anybody makes another fucking documentary calling it a very British something, I swear to God, I'll throw my TV out the window.
That's a very Irish reaction.
Very rock and roll.
Do anyone know what the world's strongest beer is? I imagine James probably does.
The strongest one? I'm guessing, but wasn't it something like BrewDog Sink the Bismarck or something like that? BrewDog had one called Tactical Nuclear Penguin, which was some ridiculous... But I think they've beaten themselves three times. I had to get the Guinness...
Yes,
I'm going to guess BrewDog. BrewDog.
They're very high on the list, and they share a syllable with the brewery that apparently do make the most potent beer at the moment, the Brewmeister Snake Venom. Brewmeister is brewed on the Isle of Moray, and their alcohol content is almost twice as high as tequila or rum, 67.5%.
Wow!
Good lord!
Jesus! You could inject that.
You really could. They're obviously there's a lot of Scotch whiskey brewed in the area, so Brewmeister apparently they do things the way you would make whiskey. They create a smoked peat malt, and then the high alcohol content, the way they do is they freeze the thing over and over again. They keep removing ice crystals to help concentrate the alcohol further and further. Snake Venom is a smoked peat malt and a crystal brew in one dangerously alcoholic bottle, according to this.
Wow.
Tasting more like hard liquor than beer, and as you can imagine, it's very thick and isn't carbonated. It's very lacking carbonation. I imagine much like real snake venom, once someone drinks it, you have to try and suck it back out of them to save their life.
Yeah, you got an antidote.
Yes. In my introduction, I mentioned putting on beer goggles and diving into a beer swimming pool. You can do that in Austria at Starkenberger's Castle. They have a beer experience with beer trivia, beer history, beer drinking, and in the basement of the castle, they had an old fermentation cellar, and they've turned it into a beer spa. 13-foot pools of warm beer. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Would you fancy swimming in a beer swimming pool?
Well, I kind of have done. When I was four, I fell in a bucket of Bass. We have a bucket, and you siphon it off the barrel. And you suck on the straw, and then you pour it into the bucket. But I leant over the bucket, and I fell headfirst in to this bucket of Bass.
So this feels like an origin story for a Greek deity.
So I do bit that in stand-up, but I pretend it's rough cider because it just makes more sense for the jokes. But it's actually a bucket of Bass that I fell in age four.
Wow. Did you inhale? Did you ingest any?
Yeah, I didn't like it back then. But yeah, I accidentally drank a load.
Wow. Well, these pools, apparently, they contain 42,000 pints as well as a little bit of water. And you can sit and bathe and immerse in them fully. And they say it's good for your skin.
Of course.
But they also say it helps cure open wounds and psoriasis, which really turns off the idea. I don't know why, but the idea of being in a pool of something that you would naturally drink, like a beer, and then mentioning open wounds and psoriasis makes the whole experience less appealing.
Yeah, I don't... Yeah.
They do say that drinking from the pool is ill-advised on their website.
Yeah.
But yeah, they obviously keep the pools relatively warm, but you can then be served a cold beer while you're in the pool, which is
that's quite surreal.
Weird.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's like the old joke. I don't know who does the joke about eating pigs and blankets while in blankets. Does that joke? About eating pigs in blankets in a sleeping bag or something. So they're eating pigs and blankets in blankets. But that's kind of like drinking cold beer in a pool of cold beer.
Yeah, I really like that. A quick one about American presidents. Who do you think the first American president to brew
Benjamin Franklin
beer at the White House? Not a president. I'm sure he would have been into his brewing. Yeah,
it was around that time.
First president to brew in the White House.
Oh.
Thomas Jefferson liked brewing. He was a bit brewer.
Knew that.
But he didn't do it at the White House. neither did George Washington. The White House wasn't a thing when Washington was there, but George Washington did believe that he should have feed beer to his troops as a staple, keep their morale high. It was Barack Obama.
Really?
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, 2011, apparently, he, at the request of President Obama, and he purchased the home brewing kit using his personal funds, he had the White House kitchens come up with some beers.
Wow.
Three styles have been brewed. They've got the White House Honey Ale, and then three additional styles. They've got White House Honey Blonde Ale, White House Honey Porter, and White House Honey Brown, and they include a pound of honey collected from the beehives on the south lawn of the White House.
Wow, that's amazing. I did know that when David Cameron met Barack Obama, they had a beer, and Barack had Bud Light. And Cameron brought with him his local, because he's Whitney Constitution, he brought a hobgoblin with him.
Yes, seems appropriate somehow.
So, yeah.
I can imagine Fox News for weeks ran with some story about Bud Light. The current use of a trans influencer in marketing Bud Light is bad enough for the right wing. To hear Obama liked it as well.
Yeah, and the slogan for Hobgoblin is "Afraid of the Dark Lager Boy." Which could sound a bit racist.
Oh no! Well, this honey ale was brewed for a Super Bowl party.
Oh.
But they also had it for St. Patrick's Day. And a United States Marine Corps Sergeant Dakota Mayer was the recipient of the Medal of Honor at the White House. And when he heard he was getting this honor, he requested to have a beer with the president. And President Obama said absolutely. And they had a drink on the terrace outside the Oval Office drinking this particular beer as well. The recipe is in the public domain because it's the work of the United States federal government.
Wow.
So, it was released on September the 1st, 2012, the recipe was, on whitehouse.gov, after at least two Freedom of Information requests.
Oh, wow.
So you can make it yourself if you wish. And the White House Honey Ale, I'm quoting here from this article, it doesn't match a specific beer style as outlined by the Beer Judge Certification Program style guidelines. Gravity, alcohol by volume, bitterness and colour are within the guidelines for a Belgian double. However, English hops and yeast are not in keeping with that style. So the beer would fall under Beer Judge Certification Program Category 23, Speciality Beer.
Wow.
So it's hard to nail down what it is, which seems, again, appropriate for a politician. But for my worst beer, I have gone to World War II.
Great.
I mentioned how the Prohibition movements sort of worked alongside the wars. Lloyd George was a Prohibitionist, and so he and people alongside him helped to shut down the pubs and breweries during World War One with the Defence of the Realm Act. They restricted licensing hours, and they doubled the price of pints, and they put heavy taxes on. And there's a book called Brewing for Victory by Brian Glover. And he says that British beer production was cut from 37 million barrels in 1913 to 19 million by 1917. It was halved.
Wow.
And not only that, but the strength of beer had dropped from a starting gravity of 1052 to 1030 over the course of the war. And the United States obviously had a nationwide prohibition in 1917. Things moved on, came to World War II, and again, we had people trying to use the war as a reason to temper British drinking habits. Lord Wolston, the Minister of Food, said the consensus of the government was that there are many people who believe that a glass of beer is not doing anybody any harm, and it was a matter of national pride to support British breweries. and indeed, British breweries set up beer for troops committees.
Beer for Troops?
Well, I think informally called that, but they decided it was their national duty to supply beer for troops, many of whom might be stationed around the world, in, like you mentioned, in the Middle East or North Africa, where alcohol was forbidden. One brewery, Whit Britain Wanted, sent 500 cases of beer to honour the defenders of Tobruk in North Africa. And there were camp-following breweries, Bushell, Watkins and Smith of Westerham. They strapped beer casks beneath the wings of fighter planes for the D-Day invasion to get beer over to France.
Wow.
Not only that, but they took it even more seriously in America. It was even more official. The United States Department of Agriculture ordered 15% of all beer production was to be set aside for the troops. And many cans of American beer during the war were painted in camouflage colours. Wow. So that they wouldn't be seen by enemy aircraft or glint and so on.
Yeah.
And there's a more contemporary British war beer, Spitfire Ale, which was made by Shepherd and Neame. Yeah, it was brewed in 1990 to commemorate the Battle of Britain, and they dubbed it, obviously, the Bottle of Britain. But they had a series of ads which slightly riled the Germans, shall we say. One of them had a black silhouette of a British pint glass and a German beer stein against a red background with the caption, "Target Identification, Ours, Theirs." And other headlines included, "Downed all over Kent, just like the Luftwaffe," and "No Fokker comes close."
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah. German tourists obviously complained, and so they were taken off tube stations in London in 1995, and the brewery responded with another poster that read, "What's so funny about these posters?"
Oh, God. Was their marketing director Piers Morgan?
Yes, or Basil Fawlty. but I've not chosen any of those as my world's worst beer. Instead, I've gone to the realm of the Royal Navy. 1944, they had a plan to supply beer to their mariners during World War II. They were anticipating quite a lengthy, entrenched war in the Pacific. And that meant, obviously, long periods of sea, shortages of beer, and, like we said, they had agreed that beer was important for morale. So they selected a brewer's called Adlams in Bristol to design a brewing boat, which would be capable of making 250 barrels of beer a week using malt extract. And they would have four of these floating breweries, basically following the fleets around the Pacific.
Sorry, I thought you had this as like sort of pirate radio, but pirate brewing.
Yes, no, well, they just thought it was the easiest way to be able to keep following what was going to be obviously a very mobile military unit in terms of like a fleet or various ships. And obviously you can't brew beer and send it such long distances. Is it skunked, is what they say for beer that's ruined by long journeys. So the further a beer has to travel, the longer it takes between the brewing process and it being opened,
hops can protect the beer. They keep it fresh, so that's why India pale ales are heavily hopped, because they have the long voyage to India back from India.
Of course.
They all said it was strong in alcohol, but no, that's where they heavily hopped. So that's where the style originated.
Because of the long journey. Mm. Well, to avoid having to hop so heavily, like I said, they planned four of these breweries, although they then reduced it to two because of various issues, including the idea that some of these drums might explode. So they took two former minesweeper boats, the Agamemnon and the Menestheus, were chosen, and they were sent to Vancouver in Canada in the summer of 1945 to be outfitted. Now, by 1944, the Menestheus had already been converted into an amenities ship. So it had been a pleasure craft or a cruise ship, and then it's been turned into a minesweeper in the Atlantic. Then it was fitted out to be an amenities ship, like I say, for the various sailors to, you know, go on board, and there'd be a movie theatre and a canteen and snooker tables or whatever. And so they then, in the hull, converted it to include a 55-barrel brewing pot powered by the ship's own boiler and with six fermentation tanks. And like I said, capable of brewing 250 barrels of beer a week. And George Brown of Truman's Brewery, at the time one of the largest breweries in England, was recruited to oversee operations on board. And he was commissioned as a Royal Navy officer.
Wow.
And I will warn you that there was only one thing on the menu here. There was a mild English ale of 3.7%. described in an article a couple of years later as distilled seawater, special brewery mash malt extract, and hop concentrate. Doesn't sound great.
No.
And another thing that got in the way was, you might have heard that I mentioned that they brought it to be outfitted in the summer of 1945. This war beer was rather stymied by the fact that there wasn't really a war.
Yeah.
Because obviously the bombs were dropped in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and Japan surrendered in August 1945. And the first test brew on board the beer boat wasn't completed until December 31st, 1945. So they used it to celebrate, unsurprisingly, New Year's Eve. And the Menestheus was the only one that they finished kitting out. They called it Davy Jones's Brewery. And then just because they, in kind of one of those things where they're like, well, we've built it now, they sent it to do a tour of Yokohama and Shanghai and Hong Kong and the other Pacific ports to dispense the beer that they had brewed.
It was like he's rubbing it in a bit after what they'd experienced there.
Really did, yeah. Didn't it? Well, not that much when you consider how crap the beer was. But yeah, after 6 months as a brewery, the Menestheus sailed back to England and they took the brew house apart again. So I'm going to go with the British Royal Navy's war beer as the world's worst beer, not least for the fact that it wasn't really a war beer, and it sounds like the fact it was made out of distilled seawater makes it sound even less appealing.
Salty peacetime beer.
So, our candidates this week for the world's worst beer are Ben's suggestion of the Vretslav Beer Wars contested brew from 1380, James's suggestion of the tribute Churchill would have really wanted, Carlsberg's special brew, and my suggestion of the salty peacetime brew made on board the Menestheus. Excellent work all around.
I think so.
I kind of think it is. It's very much in our wheelhouse because it ticks the box of, when we're looking at this, we obviously want, okay, does the beer taste a bit shit? And I think special brew and this beer tick that. And then we go, okay, does it have an interesting historical stupidity to it? And I think Ben's one and my one tick that box. So mine ticks both of the criteria I think I'd be looking at here.
And also remember,
yeah, you're in the middle of the Venn diagram here.
You absolutely yes. are. And do you remember when we chose the best cocktail? It was also one that was like,
yes.
was like petrol from a torpedo that was sieved through a slice of a loaf of bread.
Yes, that's right.
So they will go nicely together.
For
a given value of nicely.
For a given value of nice is very, it's a very movable feast at the moment. Oh, great. Well, I will gladly take the victory. Before we go, I've got to give you some of the best news of the week. And it's a beautiful romantic gesture from Kansas. Now, do you know what the state flower of Kansas is?
The chrysanthemum.
It's not. It's the beautiful sunflower.
Of course.
And not only is it Kansas's state flower, it's also the favorite flower of farmer Lee Wilson's wife. And in a beautiful act to celebrate their 50th wedding anniversary, he sacrificed 80 acres of crops to plant 80 acres of sunflowers.
Oh.
Yeah. He planted about 1.2 million sunflowers. He kept a secret for 3 months after planting them in May until their anniversary in August. His wife, Renee, said, "It made me feel very special. It couldn't be a more perfect anniversary gift." And people came from miles around to take flowers, to take photos, rather, and experience the flowers in bloom near the town of Pratt.
That is just so lovely. And it's going to be so sad when they vote in Trump in 2024. that's American speciality. Just lovely, homespun, adorable, racist authoritarians. Sorry to spoil that. Hello, America. We love you really, but not the middle bit.
Before we go, James, where can people find out more about you? Where can they buy your books? Where can they see you gig? All of that.
You can find out more about me on Instagram at Dowdswell Drinkswell. And also, I've got a website now for my beer called lazyipa.co.uk. Lazyipa.co.uk.
Very, very good. Yourself, Gordon Brown, and Russell Howard being the faces of the
business. Exactly.
If only Marty Feldman hadn't died 25 plus years ago.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, we're all off to cool down after this exhilarating podcast with a dip into the beer plunge pool. Thank you for listening to Worst Foot Forward.
Bye.
Goodbye.